Thanks for being with us tonight, everyone. We're talking with John Barber, who produced an excellent documentary based on an interview or a couple of interviews with Jim Garrison. If you've ever seen the movie JFK, Jim Garrison was portrayed in the film by Kevin Costner, the crusading DA who went after a businessman named Clay Shaw, alias Clay Bertrand, for his involvement supposedly in this cabal that killed JFK. A lot of different theories floating around out there. The Cubans did it. The mob did it. Jim Garrison and John Barber believe it was the government, the CIA, that did it. One of the criticisms that we've heard over the years, well, the FBI looked into the CIA and, you know, they don't find any evidence the CIA was involved in it. Here, we're going to play a clip from Jim Garrison. This is the clip that slugged Ruby. And it basically, in a nutshell, talks about his theory about who was responsible for the murder.
The FBI was in full cooperation with the CIA and the perpetrators of the assassination within hours. Julianne Mercer on Saturday, the day after the assassination, is telling the FBI about how she saw Jack Ruby unload a young man with a rifle on the grassy knoll. By the next day, they had a photograph of one of the participants in the assassination. An additional day of freedom was allowed him, which would not have been allowed you. Not allowed me. We would have been picked up within minutes for questioning. Right now, within minutes. He was never arrested until after he'd eliminated the Patsy.
All right, that's a clip from the documentary by John Barber. In just a moment, we're going to bring Mark Allen on from AboveTopSecret.com. But first, John, I want you to give us some context for that remark about the FBI being involved in this with the CIA.
Well, we were fortunate in that we got to do the documentary in 1992, which is well after the House Select Committee conclusions about the fact that there was conspiracy. So we had access to all of these wonderful documents. We found documents that said that J. Edgar Hoover said we have to convince the public that Oswald did it, not prove that he did it, but convince the public. So that was their only interest. And when they started the House Select Committee on Assassinations, a brilliant attorney from Philadelphia was appointed. His name was Richard Sprague, who convicted a lot of mafia people in Philadelphia, a lot of Teamsters people. He said, I'm not hiring any FBI agents or CIA agents because I'm going to be investigating them. And then the CIA called him and said that he should come over to be interviewed. He said, no, you don't interview me. I interview you, and you better bring over a couple of truckloads of documents. Well, a liberal congressman from Texas named Gonzalez led an effort to get rid of Sprague, and he was dumped. And they replaced him with a guy named Robert Blakey, who said the mafia did it in his book and dedicates his book to the Central Intelligence Agency. They never investigated the FBI or the CIA. And then after the Bay of Pigs, because Kennedy was misled on that, he got rid of Alan Dulles, who headed up the CIA. He also got rid of General Cobble, who was sent second in command of the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, Kennedy's killed, and who does Lyndon Johnson appoint? He appoints Alan Dulles, and Cabell's brother was the mayor of Dallas during the motorcade, okay? It's very easy to kind of get into these things. Who changed the route of the motorcade? Very simple. And they never investigated who changed the route of the motorcade, who moved the car with the photographers from the second or third in line to the end in line, so there'd be no real witnesses to what went on.
Actually, you have a clip from Jim Garrison that talks about the changing of the route of the motorcade. It's called Route. You want to hear that now, John?
That'd
you okay
be
with
terrific.
That? All right, let's play that now.
On Thursday evening, at the 11th hour, the route was changed by the administration of Mayor Earl Cabell. The route was changed to turn right on Houston and then left on Elm, not only going by the ambush nest where the waiting rifles were, but also going by the building in which they had pre-located the Patsy. And the indications are three teams at the minimum. With two teams shooting from the grassy knoll, that's four men, and at least one team in the back, although not on the sixth floor at that window. They could not have been going any faster as they passed the depositor, as they passed through the target zone of 11 or 12 miles an hour, which is virtually stationary if you have rifles and professionals waiting for you.
All right, that's Jim Garrison talking about the changing of the route. John, what is the implication there, that the mayor of Dallas was in on this, or that he was influenced by federal folks, or what?
Well, Jim describes it in the documentary as a no-risk operation. He says very clearly if there hadn't been cooperation from members of the Dallas Police Department, and then we interview a police officer named Roger Craig, who was absolutely appalled by the fact that he was instructed and his fellow officers instructed to stand aside and offer no protection for the motorcade that was to pass by. Now, Garrison doesn't come out and say that Mayor Cabell had something to do with changing the route, but he implies it.
Well, that's a pretty far-reaching conspiracy. I mean, and I think even today people might think, you know, maybe it was a conspiracy, but gosh, we have a hard time believing that loyal Americans in the government can be responsible.
Well, I guess it's very difficult to believe that somebody can do that, you know, because a lot of people say, well, even Blakey, well, the mafia did it. Well, let me say this about the mafia. First of all, Sam Giancana was supposed to testify before the House Select Committee. He was shot six times around the mouth, which is a way of telling people to be quiet. Another person that Garrison looked into, Johnny Roselli, mob member, was dismembered, and they found his body in a tub in the Caribbean. So let me tell you this, as answering this in a roundabout way. We invaded Iraq when no Iraqis were involved. They were Arabs who were on those planes, right?
You mean 9/11, right?
Yeah, after 9/11. Okay, so what happens is the French say that we shouldn't have done that. There weren't any Iraqis involved. And what does America do? They get all upset, so they change French toast and French fries to Liberty toast and Liberty fries, okay? In the First World War, the Germans were persona non grata. German chocolate cake 85 years ago was changed to Liberty cake. Now, if America felt the mafia had truly been involved with this assassination, there wouldn't be a pizza parlor in the country. It was the government. They changed the policy in Vietnam. Within 24 hours, they sent 50,000 troops to Vietnam. John Kennedy, 6 months before he was killed, signed a presidential directive, an executive order. It was number 11111. The United States Constitution calls for the printing of money by the United States Treasury, and that's what John Kennedy did. He felt that we shouldn't be taking our taxes and paying interest to private banks known as the Federal Reserve. The day after he was shot, they stopped printing the money. They printed it for 6 months. That executive order is still intact, but no president has had the courage to go ahead and print the money.
Okay. Well, we're definitely in the realm of conspiracy, big conspiracies, and that leads us to our next guest. As soon as we come back from this short break, we'll be joined by Mark Allen of AboveTopSecret.com. Stay with us, everyone, here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We're talking about the JFK assassination and this film, this documentary film produced by John Barber based on interviews with the late Jim Garrison. The documentary aired, I think, nationally once on a pay-per-view network. It won a film festival award. John Barber has made it available for airing many times, and it just doesn't seem to get any traction, but it is available. And we're not talking about selling it. You can watch it for free in chunks on AboveTopSecret.com. And the founder of AboveTopSecret.com, which is, I guess, has become the most successful conspiracy website in the world, Mark Allen, joins us now. Mark, how you doing?
I am doing great, gentlemen. How are you?
Hey, how does this work? I mean, you put this thing available, and can they see the whole thing?
Yeah, actually, they can. We learned early on that the attention spans online, probably because people are doing this at work, or, you know, nobody wants to sit through an hour and a half solid. So what we've learned is if you break really good content up into 6 to 10 minute pieces or chapters, it does great. And I have to say that the Garrison tapes have exceeded our expectations tremendously. And John Barber, thank you for letting us put that up there.
Oh, Mark, thank you. Listen, and thank George again. I mean, I am just so thrilled that people will be able to judge for themselves Jim Garrison's case unhindered by interference from the media or the federal government, you know, and it's up to them to make their decision as to whether or not they think Jim was on the right track.
Well, people need to see it, and now they can. Mark, give me a general sense of how popular the JFK topic remains. I mean, I know that listeners on Coast to Coast, they're interested in it. Your website looks at a whole bunch of different topics, UFO stuff, all kinds of things, but where does this one rank?
Well, I'll tell you, we did a fairly significant poll to not only our members, but all of our guests. And AboveTopSecret.com gets a little over 3.5 million visits a month. So this is a significant, you know, sampling of the Internet population. And believe it or not, 45 years later, because we did this poll back in October of 2008, the JFK assassination pulled a strong number 4 in the top 10. So, you know, the three that led it are, number 1, the New World Order, which, you know, is very broad and far-reaching. Number 2 was the ET and UFO cover-up. Very expected. Number 3 was the 9/11 attacks. Again, very expected. Number 4, the JFK assassination. I got to tell you, that surprised me.
Yeah, that's ranking right up there. Of course, the argument could be made that maybe New World Order and JFK number 4 are related. John, you were, before we took that break, you were relating a whole lot of things that happened right after JFK's murder. Do you believe the same folks are calling the shots now?
Well, I think certainly America changed, and not necessarily for the better after that. But I don't think it's some evil cabal that is wrecking the world, quite honestly. I think that is what the military calls collateral damage. I think there are handfuls of people who own things, people who own the country, people who own the banks, people who own corporations, are doing things for the benefit of themselves and their corporations. And everything that happens is a byproduct of this. You know, Harry Truman, you would have thought that he said he had a horrible regret. I would have thought it would have been dropping the second A-bomb in Nagasaki. He said the worst thing he ever did was implement the CIA. And Dwight D. Eisenhower, in his farewell address, warned America about the military-industrial complex. Those people own the country. And they're really, really smart. I mentioned this to you before, but the B-52 bomber, which is way outmoded, they still make it. And the reason they make it, these guys are so crafty, every state in the union has a company that has a contract to contribute to the B-52 so nobody in Congress ever cancels that plane.
You know, George, I'd like to jump in here real quick.
Sure.
Absolutely enthralled by this conversation I've been listening to all night. And it strikes me, and again, I don't want to be obvious in plugging our site, but our site is a collection of humanity, and we like to call it the wisdom of the crowd. And listening to John's great detail about how they really pulled one over, in Jim Garrison's belief and John Barber's belief, and frankly in my belief, on the American population, how they controlled and manipulated the media. You know, we are days away from launching ATSnews.com, a brand new site, responsible citizen journalism. I truly believe that with the impact and the accessibility of the Internet, combined with honest agents, citizens, people who actually care, I wonder if they'd be able to pull that off on us today.
Well, is there no such thing as censorship of you guys or some way to manipulate or interfere?
No way. Not a chance. We actually have it in our advertising agreements, in our contracts. Any advertiser who tries to control or limit the content in any way on our site, we just turn them down. Won't do business with them. Don't have to.
And what is the sense that you get in terms of, you know, the people who write in, who log on, whether they are they still angry about the JFK stuff? Are they still fired up about it? Or is it, in the sense I get sometimes when I read emails on this topic, is a sense of powerlessness. Well, the forces that pulled this stuff off are too big. There's nothing we can do about it.
You know, it's interesting because I sense so much anger over 9/11 for the exact same reasons. You know, it's again, it's kind of in your face. You see the telltale signs, but yeah, I would have to agree with that. And yes, to answer your question, I think there is still a lot of residual anger over JFK, and I think it was compounded and brought back to the surface after 9/11. And as our good friend Jim Mars, who John mentioned earlier, he wrote a book, you know, covers a lot of that stuff, and JFK's in that book.
Jim Mars wrote for you guys.
For us, yeah. Above Top Secret is, funnily enough, Above Top Secret happens to be the name of the book, too. But, you know, JFK is covered in that, as is 9/11. And I think those two singular events, well, two events that apparently our government really had their fingers in the cookie jar. Now, 9/11, you can question, you know, did they just get caught with their pants down? Were they involved? There's a million questions, very few answers, much like JFK.
John Barber, have you ever talked to Jim Mars, conversed with him about theories on who was responsible, who was involved? His book, Crossfire, I guess, was part of what was incorporated into the movie JFK, along with Garrison's book.
Jim was one of the people that we interviewed in the documentary, and he was absolutely wonderful. But just an additional note on the business of what the government does. One of my very, very good friends in Los Angeles was Thomas Noguchi, the coroner of Los Angeles. When Bobby Kennedy was killed, they tried to get rid of Thomas Noguchi because he reported in his coroner's report that Robert Kennedy was shot behind the left ear. The barrel of the gun could not have been more than an inch and a half away because of the extensive powder burns. And yet, with his arm extended, Sirhan wasn't closer than 6 feet from Bobby Kennedy. And there are reports now out of England, they have some video footage of CIA agents who were at the Ambassador Hotel and people bragging about the fact that they were in L.A. when they got the little son of a bitch. They eventually got rid of Thomas Noguchi because he reported that Bill Holden died a drunk because he fell down in his apartment and hit his skull against a table and bled to death. And a lot of people in Hollywood didn't want it known that Bill Holden was a lush. And so they massed together and they finally got rid of Noguchi. But they were after him for years because of his coroner's report. And you can still find that.
You know, preparing for this program, I read a lot about Jim Garrison, and there are some pretty harsh criticisms of him. For example, his claims that the CIA was spying on him and threatening him and trying to mess with his life.
Well, listen, in a very wonderful book called A Farewell to Justice, written by a history teacher named Joan Mellon, she got the list from the House Select Committee on Assassination. She names the nine people who infiltrated his office to sabotage it. And in the documentary, Lou Ivins, who was one of his lead investigators, said the worst person we have running this investigation is Jim because he trusts everybody who walks into the office and wants to help.
So they did infiltrate the investigation to keep tabs on it and to subvert it?
Absolutely. And Walter Sheridan from NBC tried to bribe his key witness, Perry Russo, but Garrison had Russo wired, and we got this guy from NBC trying to bribe Garrison, and he goes on NBC and does a white paper report that was so slanderous, they had to give Jim Garrison equal time. They gave him a half an hour. Do you think that would happen in modern America? I mean, Ronald Reagan was the one that got rid of the Fairness Doctrine. When I was doing the AM show and interviewed Reagan, the next day I had to have a Democrat on, and then I had to have a socialist on. There would be no Fox News if it hadn't been for Ronald Reagan getting rid of the Fairness Doctrine.
Why is it, you suppose, your documentary hasn't been aired since that one time that you mentioned?
You know, I can't quite understand. Maybe it's because it's the truth and it's very difficult to digest. But there are so many additional networks and outlets now for television, but it seems to be more straws in the same septic tank. I mean, I find very little anymore that's uplifting on television. I find myself having to listen to radio. But
well, we're glad you're here. We're glad everyone is here tonight. We're talking with John Barber and Mark Allen about the JFK assassination and other conspiracies. Stay with us, everyone. We'll be back with more right after these messages. That old Bob Seger song, somehow appropriate, sort of a summary of Jim Garrison's life. He certainly was going against the wind in his attempts to prosecute Clay Shaw for the murder or involvement with the murder of JFK. And John Barber, who created this documentary film about Jim Garrison and his attempts to find justice in that case, has also gone against the wind a little bit. Has had a lot of trouble getting his film aired anywhere and people get a chance to see it, and now he's got a place on AboveTopSecret.com. Would Jim Garrison do it all over again? Because there were significant personal consequences for him, personal and professional, and in many ways his life sort of fell apart after he went after this one suspect. So would he do it again? When we come back, we'll hear one more clip from the film, and we'll resume our conversations with John Barber and with Mark Allen. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. We're talking with John Barber and Mark Allen about conspiracies, specifically the JFK assassination. Jim Garrison, a lot of ups and downs in his life, mostly downs following his attempts to pursue a prosecution in the JFK assassination. You know, he did hold another office. I think he was elected judge, but he was voted out as DA. There were accusations he accepted bribes. He was acquitted. I think Harry Connick Sr. is the guy who beat him in an election for the DA's office, and a lot of bad stuff happened to him. We're going to play our one more clip about the personal side of Jim Garrison and whether he would do it all again, as asked by John Barber.
I wish I could say in heroic words that, yes, I would do it again. But actually, what the investigation cost me, a magnificent office which took years to build up, and a tremendous amount of emotional involvement, not unrelated to my personal concern about what happened to John Kennedy and what was obviously happening to America. I'd say that I don't know if I would do it again because of the emotional price I paid.
John Barber, do you believe him, or is he just saying that for effect? Do you believe that he would not have proceeded the same way?
Well, I don't think that Jim was constitutionally capable of not pursuing it. It was something he would have to do. But I think because of the damage that it caused his family, and you notice he also said, my concerns about what was happening to America. At the time of that trial, he said publicly, the United States Constitution is on life support. Now, that was 40 years ago, and I don't think the Constitution has come off life support since that time. I just admired them. He was the third brightest human being I ever met. And to show you what a decent guy was, I mean, he did divorce his wife, and he did win another term. Right after. I mean, Harry Connick beat him the third time around, but not the second time. And the government was still concerned that he might pursue the case, which he said he would do. And so that's why they tried to sabotage him with these fake trials. And also, he was going to bring Clay Shaw to trial for perjury. They had proved that he knew Lee Harvey Oswald and David Ferry. So perjury was a slam dunk. And the federal government moved in and disallowed him from pursuing that prosecution. And so, Jim was just an enormously decent man, and when he was dying, and it may have been cancer, I'm not sure if it was cancer or not, he had been divorced from his wife, and his ex-wife was on hard times, so he asked to remarry her so that she could get his pension, and she did.
Well, you know, I've been reading these websites, and some of them are really brutal on the guy, you know, paint all kind of a nasty picture of him. But I'll tell you, listening to these clips and then seeing your program, he doesn't sound like the wacko that he's been portrayed to be by some of these critics.
He's not. I mean, it just spelled by, you know, he reminded me a lot of of Ralph Nader, except that Ralph didn't have any sense of humor. Garrison had an enormous sense of humor. I mean, if I were Ralph Nader and knew what Ralph knew, I would be screaming at the top of my lungs. I'd be so angry. But Ralph was always calm and peaceful, so you could listen to what it was that he had to say. And the same thing with Garrison. He was very reasonable when he talked about his case, and he even had a sense of humor about it. But the attacks on him are all totally unreasonable.
Mark Allen, give me a sense. You sort of have your finger on the pulse of the public, at least the folks who are interested in conspiracies. Why does this resonate 45 years later? And is it just with old guys like me who are interested in it, or is there a new generation of online folks who want to know the truth about JFK?
Well, that's a huge, huge question. It seems that these, especially the attacks against Garrison, you know, where they just blatantly call him a nut, they sabotage him at every turn. It's almost as if they, whoever they are, tries to paint this picture that there's no such thing as a conspiracy. You know, and anyone who investigates or is interested in or looks into conspiracy theories is summarily painted as a nut job by the mainstream media as well. Well, you know, there's several real ones that they've actually been caught with their pants down. And not too long ago, 2007, we had the Barksdale nuclear missile incident, which, you know, many people are familiar with. Well, generals got fired. That was a complete cover-up. We had Project Northwoods, which I don't know if you're familiar with or not.
No, what's that?
That's where the Joint Chiefs of Staff actually sat down back in the late 60s, trying to figure out how to deal with Fidel Castro. And they devised a plan on paper, obviously never executed it, but they literally devised a plan to fly an American commercial airliner, crash it, and blame it on Cubans. Now, what does that sound like?
Well, Mark, didn't George Bush suggest that they paint an airplane with UN emblem on it and then shoot it down and blame the Iraqis for it?
Yeah, that's certainly out there. But what I'm talking about are absolutely documented. You know, Freedom of Information Act filings have been filed. They've been returned. The documents are in hand. These are indisputable, real conspiratorial cover-ups that our government's been involved in. So I think as the, you know, younger generation is obviously, in my humble opinion, much smarter at 18, 19, and 20 than we were. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact of the internet. You know, you can literally go online today and you pretty much have the sum total of human knowledge and intelligence at your fingertips. We didn't have that when I was 20 or 18 or 19. And as these young folks are looking into situations, maybe they hear something on the 6 o'clock news and it just doesn't ring true. Maybe they read something. Maybe a college professor tells them something. So they start investigating. They go to the internet. And as they look these things up and they find out, wow, Barksdale really happened. We have another one, the Cisco routers being counterfeited in China. We actually broke this story, and the New York Times picked it up. Heck, everybody picked it up. And it's a huge scandal. The FBI is involved. People have gone to prison, and not a word. Nobody heard a word about it.
You know, I was going to ask you about the future of conspiracy media. If your site, AboveTopSecret.com, can put John's film on and people can view it, whereas they couldn't see it on television, even cable television, whether that represents the future of conspiracy media, but maybe the question is all media. I mean, for me, it's hard to believe that somebody like you and your site can be unregulated and put whatever you want to on it. I can't believe they would let you get away with that.
Well, it's really a simple matter of where the money comes from. And we're not bought out. We haven't sold out, and we never will. There's no reason to. The internet is really sort of uncontrollable because it's not going over airwaves that the FCC can control. It's peer-to-peer. It's computer-to-computer. So to think that you're going to be able to control that is lunacy, you know, short of just shutting it down. Well, good luck with that. Try getting reelected if you're the senator or the congressman who shuts down the internet today. So in reality, you know, the advertisers just don't have the control online that they had on television, especially back in the 60s when there was only three stations and then maybe one local. The internet is global. And again, it's my computer is as tied into the internet and as big a part of the internet as the biggest server rack, you know, anywhere else. So it's really hard to control, number one. Number two, advertising is really at arm's length. There's agencies involved, and there's just so many advertisers out there that want on the internet that really it's just it's an irrational thought to me to consider any advertiser trying to control the content on a site. That's a huge benefit. It truly is the opportunity of humanity for the wisdom of the crowd to come forward.
Well, I know that the TV mediums, TV news, for example, folks like I work for, I don't know about radio for sure, but newspapers are certainly suffering as people spend more of their time and get more of their information from the internet. And I, you know, mediums, other media are trying to have an online presence at places like yours so that they can survive.
Well, we sure hope that the future, my family included, certainly hope that the future of media is where we're headed and what our vision is. And, you know, George, we really hope with our new media portal to see some George Knapp footage in the near future, if we can talk about that.
Yeah, well, we'll see what we can do. Hey, John, back to you. Is there more material that you have that was not included in the film? And if so, what are you going to do with it?
There's quite a bit of material left there, but I don't know. First of all, I don't have the financial wherewithal to do a part two. I would certainly do a part two if I could. But I think the wonderful thing about what Mark is doing is this business about citizen reporting. I mean, Studs Terkel did a wonderful book called Working, where he just interviewed people who worked and put it out as a book, and it was absolutely brilliant. Howard Zinn did a wonderful history book called The People's History of the United States, which was one of the best history books ever written. And I think what's going to happen with Mark's site is he's going to discover maybe the next Edward R. Murrow, but he might discover the next Lenny Bruce or Mort Sahl or Irma Bombeck. I mean, having the opportunity to have this outlet, there is no other way that these kind of voices are going to be heard in contemporary popular media or commercial media.
I completely agree, and we are so fortunate to have built the audience we have that we can actually do this. I mean, that's the amazing part. Just, in, you know, for me personally, it's just astounding. You know, wake up every day and be able to be part of this is phenomenal. And I'm an old guy. I turned 46 Monday. Last Monday I turned 46. And to be able to participate in this and watch it grow and watch it happen is absolutely astounding. And I got to tell you, the opportunity to put the Garrison tapes up and just watch that and watch people by the thousands come view something that, in America anyway, they really hadn't had a chance to view.
Okay, can you tell us numbers? Do you have numbers?
Yeah, I do. You know, the site had only been up, the new media portal had only been up for about 5 days when we got John's documentary up. So the traffic was really minute. And in spite of how minute the traffic was, this thing shot to among the top five videos ever on the site. And we've got, you know, 30,000-40,000 views, you know, in the first 10-12 days of this thing. And it's just phenomenal. I mean, when the site gets huge, that won't be a big number. But for a very small, brand spanking new site, those are huge numbers. 30,000 or 40,000 more Americans saw this video. And we're going to keep it up. And hopefully after tonight's show, 100,000 will see it. Hopefully a million will see it.
Well, we hope so. John, yeah. You had said that in the beginning of this interview, you didn't really want to make any more money on it. You just want people to see it. Is that really going to be enough?
Listen, I was shocked when I heard Mark say he was old at 46. That's when I started Real People. I mean, I'm 1 year past the Arizona speed limit. You know? I would love to be able to make the second part, and I may end up making the second part, but there's something really intriguing about the fact that it shot up to 40,000 people, because I don't know what it is, and I'm not metaphysical or spiritual or anything like that, but there's something sort of telepathic about something good. One of the public screenings I had for the documentary was at the Lemley Theater in Los Angeles, and there was absolutely no publicity. I was going to go in for a week, and I was going to introduce the film and then do questions and answers. No publicity, no radio, no TV. I just told a few people. every night was sold out. And we spoke for 2 hours after every single screening. And the one thing that I'd love to be able to do, and hopefully it might come from this, is there are universities and colleges that book all kinds of speakers. I would love to be able to go someplace and screen this and take questions and answers from people.
Well, maybe some offers like that will come in. If they come to me, I'll let you know. I want to ask some more about Jim Garrison, the man. Did he, when he died, was he a broken man? Was he defeated, demoralized, depressed?
No, I'll tell you. He was very, very ill. And Oliver Stone did something that I will never quite forgive him for. Oliver wanted to do an interview with Jim on his deathbed. The family refused because they never wanted his father shown in that light. And Oliver Stone says, no, we'll never show it. Well, they shot the footage, and he showed it. So it showed Jim as a broken man. But Jim was about 6'5", deep bass baritone voice. And one of his best friends was about 5'7". And when Jim was ready to die, he said, when I die, you're going to get my penile implant.
The gift that keeps on giving, I guess.
Oh, boy. You know, I have a question, if I may interject real quickly, and this is something that has bothered me my whole life, and I think we've got the guy who might be able to answer it on the line here, and I'm sure I'm not the only guy that ever wondered. There's a story about a car that got scrubbed clean, detailed, washed, shined, polished, immediately after the assassination. Is that true?
Yes, that's the limousine. As a matter of fact, you'll see in the documentary, you'll see a bullet hole in the windshield.
Yep.
You'll see a bullet hole on the dashboard. Now, there's a major piece of forensic evidence which was totally destroyed by Ford Motor Company.
Yep.
That's true. I mean, all the evidence was destroyed. I mean, Lee Harvey Oswald, they gave him a paraffin test, which tells whether or not you fired a rifle. Then the test was negative.
Yep.
It was reported negative, and the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, said it was positive.
George, sorry about that. I know you're supposed to ask the questions, but
No, that's okay. You know, I know that one of the criticisms of Jim Garrison's theories was this question of whether there really was a link between Oswald and Guy Bannister, who was the FBI agent or ex-FBI agent who had an office there. There was a witness who was, I guess, Bannister's secretary, who I guess in the opinion of some of the critics just wasn't very believable. I think the House Select Committee found her unbelievable and therefore shed some doubt on the link between Bannister and Oswald.
Well, Oswald did know Bannister because when he distributed those Fair Play for Cuba leaflets, they had Bannister's address on them. I'll tell you a couple of interesting sidebar stories about the documentary. One of my cameramen was a fellow named George Elkins, really bright young cameraman. He did not know that his father, for over 30 years, was in military intelligence. And, you know, the CIA has Academy Awards and Emmy Awards, and they hire people to film them. People get their little pins, put them on their lapel, they're taped, they say a few words, and they take them off, and they put them in a safe somewhere. Well, George was called to do one of these awards in Washington. He said, they asked him on the phone how much it would cost, and he gave him a figure of $50,000, okay? He said by the time he got off the phone, the $50,000 was in his bank account. His father was curious to see what his son was working on and saw the documentary. George Elkins called me and said, my father wants to meet you. My father just told me he was in military intelligence. Went to a little restaurant called Patty's in Toluca Lake. A week later, I sat down with him, and he put his arm around me. He said, John, there was a whole lot that I wanted to tell you. He said, I'm retired now, and I get a great pension. I don't want to waste your time coming over here. I'm not going to tell you what I was going to tell you, but I'll tell you this. I was in military intelligence. I was high up in Vietnam, but I was in Miami when we were issued all the maps by the military telling us what offices we would occupy in Havana, once we took over. The Navy was going to have this office, the Marines this office, and when John Kennedy withheld the air support, He said, we were screaming, we got to kill the son of a bitch. And the other thing I'll tell you.
Well, you're going to have to tell me after we come back from this break, though, that that song from Ace, How Long, is our cue that we're going to take a break. We'll be back with Mark Allen, John Barber, talking about Jim Garrison and JFK, and then we'll be going to your calls as well. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast.